Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the Senate voted on two competing measures today that would reopen the federal government. Neither bill garnered the required 60 votes, however. And President Trump announced that he will postpone the State of the Union address. This came after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said that she would not authorize the address so long as the government was closed. The partial government shutdown is now in its 34th day, with federal workers projected to soon miss their second paycheck. Next, Alex Salmond, who served as the First Minister of Scotland from 2007 to 2014 and who was leader of the Scottish National Party for more than 20 years, was arrested yesterday and charged with sex crimes. The arrest took place 2 weeks after Salmond won a lawsuit against Scottish authorities relating to their investigative practices in the case. Then we continue our regular weekly segment, Veterans for Peace, where we'll discuss contemporary issues of war and peace that affect veterans, their families, and the country as a whole. And then a lot of Democrats are running for president. Major media outlets say that as many as 24 Democrats are considering or have already announced campaigns. There are major names like Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, and Elizabeth Warren, newcomers like Kamala Harris and Tulsi Gabbard, and unknowns like South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg and Maryland Congressman John Delaney. But are any of these politicians really any different from previous Democratic candidates? And do many of them even have a chance to beat Donald Trump? And finally, our friend and contributor Ted Rall recently had a major court decision go against him in California. This was a case that had very important implications for Americans' constitutional rights to freedom of speech. In the end, the court decided essentially that Ted's right to criticize the Los Angeles Police Department was less important than the Los Angeles Times' right to block Ted's right to freedom of speech. It's a case with very important constitutional implications. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the federal shutdown. The Senate voted on two competing measures today that would reopen the federal government. Neither bill garnered the required 60 votes, however, and President Trump announced that he will postpone the State of the Union address. This came after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said that she would not authorize the address so long as the government was closed. The partial government shutdown is now in its 34th day, with federal workers projected to soon miss their second paycheck. We recorded the following segment about 2 hours before the vote was taken. We're joined from Detroit by Julie Hurwitz. She's a civil rights attorney and partner at the law firm of Goodman, Hurwitz, and James. Welcome back, Julie.
Glad to be here.
Boy, where do we even start with this? 34 days. This is a real crisis for most federal workers here in the Washington area. There are actually lines at places like food pantries, food banks. They're giving out free peanut butter. They're giving out surplus government cheese. But people are still in danger of losing their houses, losing their cars, because they really do live paycheck to paycheck.
It's just tragic. It's a travesty. And we're not even looking, nor is the mass media looking so much at the ripple effect that this is all having on virtually everybody in the country, because businesses can't run their operations. They've got no clientele. You got mortgage companies, you got banks, you got restaurants, you got the travel industry, the airline industry. They're losing hundreds of millions of dollars themselves just in lost business as a result of this, whatever the word should be to describe it. I can't even conjure up the word. And the irony is that it's clear that this ridiculous wall that Trump wants to build won't even work for what he's trying to accomplish with it. That came out pretty clearly during Chapo's criminal trial, where he described the ways that he was able to smuggle millions of dollars of illegal drugs into this country. With even had there been a wall, they all would have been able to come in the way that he described it.
It's easy to forget that this entire thing was utterly avoidable, that this entire crisis is a result of it's a power play between Democrats on Capitol Hill and the president, and they're willing to go to the mat despite the fact that so many people are being harmed.
Well, I have a really hard time vilifying the Democratic Party for the position they're taking here.
You took the words out of my mouth. I was going to lay this at the feet of Donald Trump, because it was Donald Trump who elected to shut down the government to prove a political point. And that was without any thought to the suffering that federal workers are going to have to endure.
Another irony about all of this is this is the strategy of a party that is now controlled by the federalist ideology, which says that government's bad, keep government out of our lives, keep government out of our pockets. And this is a perfect example of what will happen in this country without an operating and fully funded government.
And again, you see that what's considered essential services. I mean, we have, for instance, clinics and spaces that are designed to help women's trying to escape from abuse. Those are being affected. Those are losing their funds. Right now, people are still getting food stamps. That might be cut off soon. But the essential services, when it comes to the instruments of state repression, they keep going and going and going. Although I have to say prison guards, I believe, John, in the federal prisons are not being paid.
They are not being paid. And they've run to the media to make sure everybody knows they're not being paid.
Go ahead, Julie.
Another really interesting dichotomy is that the Army Corps of Engineers is still fully funded. And yet, and what essential services do they provide to the population of this country? I find that bizarre.
And then the Coast Guard, which actually does provide an essential service, is not being paid. For the first time since the Revolutionary War, by the way.
They're telling members of the Coast Guard to hold garage sales
yes.
and babysit
yes.
if they need more money.
Or go get a job pet walking.
Yes.
Yeah, dog walking.
And driving Uber. Correct.
And it's also being carried over into safeties at work for example, flight attendants. I just read in today's New York Times that the flight attendants union is talking about walking out because air traffic controllers and TSA are not able to do their jobs, then these planes are taken off into extremely dangerous, potentially dangerous circumstances.
Let's turn to the other part of this story, which is about the State of the Union.
Mm-hmm.
Again, Nancy Pelosi said to Trump, if the government's not going to be open, don't have the State of the Union address. Personally, I thought that would be a merciful development because the State of the Union is always awful to watch, no matter who's president. But then Trump, in retaliation, canceled her ability to use military aircraft to go to Afghanistan. Then Trump said that he's going to have the State of the Union somewhere else. Now he seems to be backing down. Again, for people who are not getting paid or people who are not able to access vital services, this kind of a battle about the State of the Union will seem pretty infantile.
It's ridiculous, for lack of a better word. I agree. It's certainly symbolic, but in terms of any concrete impact on people's lives, I agree with you completely. It's infantile. That's a good word for it. But I'm quite relieved myself that we're not going to have to listen to this man spew whatever venom he plans to say during his State of the Union address, filled with whatever lies he's going to fill it with. So if there's one positive fallout from this entire situation, it's we're not going to have to listen to his State of the Union address next week. I think Pelosi suggested that he submitted in writing.
Which is the way it was done for 140 years of our history.
Yeah.
Or longer, 160 yeah. years.
This is not part of the Constitution. The State of the Union is really just a self-congratulatory remarks by whoever the sitting president is about how great the State of the Union is. You never get up and I've never heard a president get up and say, you know what? We have income inequality such that the country is being completely polarized on a class basis. We have a situation in our country where even though we have 5% of the world's population, we have 25% of all of the world's prisoners. It's a shame that while we're so wealthy, there's increasing poverty, that in the state of California, the fifth largest economy in the world, there's more poor children than any other state in the union. You never hear an actual critique of the State of the Union.
Well, maybe FDR came close, but even then, and I agree completely. And the impact that this is having on students and parents and the ability to even pay child support. There are people who are risking being arrested now for late child support payments, and the process you have to go through to get a waiver is you have to hire a lawyer, and you can't afford to hire a lawyer, and it's a very it's a very tedious process you have to go through when you're in the midst of dealing with divorce and paying your child support money to raise your kids. And people are losing homes. People are not able to get student loans. I mean, it's just, and the food. Let's talk about food. I mean, what did they just say that they're going to start paying for perishable food inspections again or not? I lost track of that one, but you know, with the type of, you know, potential harmful health effects that could impact huge numbers of people in this country if we're eating food that's tainted and there's no mechanism to protect us from that, who knows what epidemic could occur from that. I mean, the whole thing is Kafkaesque.
It is.
Quite frankly.
It is. And then you have the Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross, who claims to be a billionaire, but it turns out that he lied about that. But anyway, close to a billionaire. He appeared on CNBC this morning to say that he just doesn't understand why people are out there, why government employees are out there looking for free food. He said that that it doesn't make sense because their back pay is guaranteed. And what they should do is just go to the bank or the credit union and ask for a loan against future earnings.
Let them eat cake. I mean, here's Wilbur Ross. Let's just give him the, okay, he's a billionaire. He says he is. He says he has $2 billion. Here you have, right not far from us, Julie, you have people in long, long lines. These are furloughed government employees, people not being paid, many of them well-dressed, waiting in line for sometimes like maybe 45 minutes to get a free meal.
No, there was an editorial cartoon today of two FBI agents at a soup kitchen, and they're showing their IDs, and it says FBI, special agent, and the woman at the soup kitchen says, no, no, you don't have to do that. You can just come in and take what you want.
Right.
And here you have Wilbur Ross, billionaire, like so many others in the Trump administration, or any American government for that matter, saying, I just don't get it.
Yeah, he just doesn't
Why don't they just go get a loan? It's an amazing level of callousness, and it really exemplifies the disconnect between those who run the government and those who are supposed to be represented by the government, meaning we the people. Anyway, John, I think we are out of time.
We are out of time. We were very pleased to be joined from Detroit by Julie Hurwitz. She is a civil rights attorney and partner at the law firm of Goodman, Hurwitz & James. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Alex Salmond, who served as First Minister of Scotland from 2007 to 2014, and who was leader of the Scottish National Party for more than 20 years, was arrested yesterday and charged with sex crimes. The arrest took place 2 weeks after Salmond won a lawsuit against Scottish authorities relating to their investigative practices in this case. We're joined from Edinburgh, Scotland, by Mark Hurst. He's the editor-in-chief of Sputnik's Edinburgh Bureau. Welcome back, Mark.
Hello, how are you?
Mark, thanks for joining us. Can you tell us what these charges are against Alex Salmond, and how do they relate to the investigation, at least the investigation in its early stages?
Well, there are several charges being laid, including attempted rape and also numerous charges of sexual assault. In the UK, unfortunately, the details of those are not allowed to be reported on due to reporting restrictions by the court. What I can say, though, is that there is a wide sense of shock right across the country, regardless of where you sit in terms of Mr. Salmond's politics. I think this is a politician of who had been a huge political figure right across the UK, not just in Scotland. So this will undoubtedly send shockwaves right across the political establishment and, I think, quite clearly amongst the wider public.
Yeah, I'm surprised by it. And I'm wondering, too, what the political reaction is in Scotland. Do Scottish political figures see this as a setup, as a hit job, or is this some kind of a personal problem that Alex Salmond has?
Well, some of the political politicians that I've spoken to today have raised an eyebrow about the timing of this. As you mentioned there, Salmon, just 2 weeks ago in Scotland's highest court, won a case that he brought against the Scottish government, which he once led, for failure to observe the correct procedure in relation to investigations that they had undertaken. And the political context of that was that Salmon was making strong indications that he was thinking about a return to frontline politics. And although this criminal investigation by the police was known to be underway, I don't think anyone was expecting the seriousness of these charges that have emerged today, you know, coming to light. I think it's quite clear there was a divide opening up between Mr. Salmond and the current First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, who once was a protege of Mr. Salmond. There was clear political differences between the two, and undoubtedly there'll be questions raised. Whether that has a bearing on the criminal case, I think, is neither here nor there. I think the criminal case, we'll have to see how that emerges, but certainly any aspiration that Mr. Salmon may have had for making a return to frontline politics are very much on pause now.
If he had returned to frontline politics, and it seems quite likely now that if that was the plan, and if people knew that was the plan, and it's no longer the plan, given the gravity of the charges and the sensational character of them, if he had returned, what would it have meant politically? In other words, Nicola Sturgeon is the leader of the Scottish National Party, now the party that Salmon once led. He was the architect of the Scottish independence referendum that failed before. Of course, things have changed so much now since Scotland, more or less, certainly the majority opinion is against leaving the EU at the very moment that the United Kingdom is preparing to leave the EU. Anyway, what would Salmon's return to frontline politics actually signify in terms of policy or direction for the Scottish political scene?
Salmon has a reputation for being head and shoulders above most other politicians in terms of his statesmanship and his intellect. He still has a very politically strategic mind. I think I've known Alex Salmon for over 20 years myself, and certainly I've had discussions with him in the last few months in which he was making it clear not only to me but to others that he was certainly planning a return to frontline politics, and I'm certain that intention would be fed back to the current leadership of the Scottish National Party. Now, there is a very distinct leadership change or distinction in the leadership styles of both Nicola Sturgeon, the current First Minister, and Alex Salmond. Salmond has made, just in the last few days, less than veiled criticisms of the First Minister, saying she's being overly cautious when it comes to pushing for a second Scottish independence referendum. So there will be some who will regard the timing of these charges as more than a coincidence. But again, obviously the case will be decided and determined by a criminal court. The political ramifications, however, will be very far-reaching, and I think the pressure that I'm certain Nicola Sturgeon has been under because of these criticisms from the former First Minister, she will perhaps be sighing some relief that that pressure no longer exists, at least for now.
And what does this do to Scottish politics? Certainly this is going to stir things up, but what does it do to the Scottish National Party, if anything?
I think it was clear that there has been a growing sense of frustration at the lack of enthusiasm or apparent enthusiasm that the current First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, has demonstrated. It's clear that the SNP seem very split at the moment. Half of their support feels that now is Scotland will never have a better time than now to strike for its independence, given the wider political chaos that we're seeing right across the UK as a result of Brexit. And certainly I know from speaking to Alex Salmond directly myself, he felt that this was the time to bring forward fresh plans for independence. Nicola Sturgeon has always been, by contrast, a very cautious politician. She's adopted an approach which is similar to don't frighten the horses, steady as she goes, a kind of gradualist movement towards securing independence. Whether that would actually deliver independence, no one can say, but certainly it would seem as a result of this that that movement or that pressure to move quickly on independence has been taken off the table, I would say.
Last question, 1 minute left. Talk about Alex Salmond's international orientation. It seemed from what I could see earlier that he was more for a rapprochement with Russia or good relations with Russia. And given the UK in general's orientation towards Russia, is there any significant foreign policy difference between him and others and him and, say, Sturgeon inside Scotland?
Alex Salmond always had a more internationalist perspective on where Scotland's place, an independent Scotland's place, would be in the world. And certainly he's been criticised in the past for making warm statements congratulating President Putin on some of the reforms and policies that have taken place in Russia. And certainly he would be opposed to the kind of confrontation and hysteria that we've seen so much of amongst the liberal politicians, the liberal elites. That contrasts very much to Nicola Sturgeon. Nicola Sturgeon is very much a domestic politician who sees herself very much in a Scottish or a UK context. And she's been very silent, actually, on her foreign policy objectives. So the big difference between the two, I think Salmond's legacy stands far higher than Nicola's, however, in that regard.
Well, this is primarily, or it seems to be primarily, a criminal case, but with political elements. We'll continue to follow it as it works its way through the courts. We were happy to be joined from Edinburgh, Scotland, by Mark Hurst. Mark is the editor-in-chief of Sputnik's Edinburgh Bureau. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
It's time again for our regular weekly segment, Veterans for Peace, where we'll discuss contemporary issues of war and peace that affect veterans, their families, and the country as a whole. We're joined from California by Jerry Condon. He's a Vietnam-era veteran and war resister who has been a peace and solidarity activist for almost 50 years, currently as national president of Veterans for Peace. Welcome back, Jerry.
Glad to be here.
Jerry, let's start with Venezuela. It's so much in the news. The United States, I'm going to just make a value judgment here, launched one of the most brazen coup attempts, at least in my lifetime. And we saw a response today from the Russian government, the Chinese government, the Turkish government, the Cuban government, and others. Tell us a little bit about what you think about Venezuela and what we should expect in the coming days.
Again, also, with Trump saying all options are on
the table.
Yep.
Right. Well, it's deja vu all over again, and it's really outrageous. You know, the government shutdown continues. I guess that just means that the federal employees don't get paid, but the agents of imperialism seem to be working overtime in Latin America. You know, Veterans for Peace actually formed in 1985, in part as a result of the U.S.-backed Contra War in Nicaragua at the time. And a lot of veterans were very concerned about seeing another Vietnam War in Central America. And, of course, that war against Nicaragua continues as well. There's a concerted attempt to undermine the progressive government of Nicaragua. There's tightening the screws and placing new sanctions on Cuba is coming up. But here we have in Venezuela just a blatant old-style imperialism. We're going to overthrow your government, whether it takes military or not. In the meantime, they've been undermining the government for many, many months and several years now with the extreme sanctions, making the whole economy scream there, causing great problems. And there is a substantial middle class and a very substantial oligarchy still in Venezuela for the U.S. to work with. So this is very, very scary and very bold. And as you say, they're even leaving on the table the possibility of military intervention. And I really believed that if the U.S. intervenes militarily in Venezuela, they're going to wake up a sleeping giant in this country, and we're going to see an anti-war movement come back like we haven't seen it in quite a few years.
The George W. Bush administration had the Axis of Evil. Remember, that was January 2002, where he proclaimed Iraq, Iran, and North Korea the Axis of Evil. Then that preceded what was then the invasion by the United States of Iraq. Again, that at that moment, the North Koreans, the DPRK, looking at all of that, said, okay, we're part of that axis, so guess what? We're going to drop out of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and start building nuclear weapons again, which they did exactly that. So there you have the axis of evil, the evil three. Now you have the troika of tyranny. That's the new formula. That's Nicaragua, Cuba, Venezuela. There's a line of continuity, Jerry Condon, between the axis of evil and the troika of tyranny. And that continuity, besides the big picture of U.S. imperialism, is the person of John Bolton. He was there for both, and he was the one who actually declared this troika of tyranny, again, as a prelude to this obviously imperialist regime change effort.
That's right. You know, there's a lot of confusion about, you know, what's Trump really want to do here in terms of U.S. military intervention, generally speaking. You know, when he talks about wanting to pull the troops out from Syria, with pursuing some kind of peace negotiations with North Korea, you know, he doesn't even get support from the Democrats when he does that. And, you know, a lot of people on the left are suspicious of his motives. But, you know, when he surrounds himself with people like John Bolton and Mike Pompeo, you know, who are out and out hardline hawk interventionists, then, you know, I think that tells us a lot. And obviously the U.S. has been very actively intervening with a certain amount of success from their perspective all over Latin America in the last several years. They've succeeded in helping to turn a number of left governments back to hard right governments, especially and very alarmingly in Brazil.
It's really something, Jerry. You've been down, you Veterans for Peace have been down at the border. You have a deported chapter of Veterans for Peace, U.S. veterans who are then subsequently deported by the U.S. government. I want to talk about something Mike Pence said about the Trump administration's coup efforts in Venezuela. He was asked by Trish Regan from Fox News, doesn't this seem a little bit out of character? Trump has said the U.S. government should avoid foreign entanglements, trying to withdraw troops from Syria. And why then is the U.S. intervening in Latin America against Venezuela? And here's what Mike Pence said, quote, while President Trump has made no secret of the fact that he is not a fan of American deployments all over the world and American entanglements, our first president, George Washington, had the same concerns, Trump and Washington. And yet President Trump has always had a very different view of our hemisphere. He's long understood that the United States has a special responsibility to support and nurture democracy and freedom in this hemisphere. I mean, it's amazing. Donald Trump doesn't care, doesn't want to have foreign entanglements, but his love of the people of Latin America
and concern for their human rights.
And he wants to nurture democracy for Latin Americans. Amazing.
That translates into, you know, the U.S. This is the U.S. considers Latin America their backyard, and they should be able to control what goes on in Latin America. The Monroe Doctrine from many years ago is basically still in full force. I'm glad you mentioned our deported veterans and chapter in Tijuana, because they've been working closely with the asylum seekers who are from Central America, primarily from Honduras. Okay, so why are they fleeing from Honduras? Because of, you know, incredible poverty and great violence from both the government and criminal gangs that are running rampant in Honduras, all as a direct result of the U.S.-backed coup in Honduras. So, you know, if the U.S. succeeds in overthrowing the government of Venezuela, we're going to have a bunch of Venezuelans at the border and trying to get into the United States.
Yeah,
and you know that's true.
And Pence talking about nurturing freedom for Latin Americans, at the same time building the wall, having the government shut down now for 34 days to get the wall, and have criminally prosecuting people who might leave water in the desert so these Latin Americans who we care so much about their, quote, freedom, don't die of thirst. Anyway, truly disgusting.
Yeah, well, so we have to do more than be outraged. It's really good we're talking about it, because, you know, people get too easily confused. You know, there's been an incredible amount of propaganda against the Maduro government. And, you know, people even in the peace movement get confused and disarmed in some cases by that kind of propaganda. So it's really important for people to get a clear picture of what's going on. And it's nothing more or less than U.S. imperialism and U.S. domination and you know, profit-driven corporate control of all Latin America. Any government that steps up and puts the needs of its own people above the needs of U.S. and multinational corporations is going to be a target. And, you know, whether it's a great government, a good government, or a failing government, there's no way that the U.S. has the right to do that. And, you know, people need to get out in the streets. I'm glad to see that there are actually emergency demonstrations being organized in cities around the U.S. today and tomorrow, and I'm sure for the next few weeks. And I know Veterans for Peace is going to be very actively involved. We have chapters in over 100 U.S. cities, and we're going to be in the streets demanding an end to U.S. intervention in Venezuela.
Jerry, I'd like to turn to a different issue now, and that's an issue that came up in the Supreme Court, or actually it didn't come up in the Supreme Court because the court refused to hear it. And this was an appeal of a case by veterans who were suing the military contracting giant KBR because of the health effects of exposure to military burn pits overseas. I have a personal interest in this because my best friend from high school was actually in charge of the burn pits in Iraq and came home from Iraq with a very rare form of brain cancer called deep brain glioblastoma. 46 years old, he only lived for 8 months after they found this thing. And then soon after, Joe Biden's son, who also was exposed to the burn pits, came down with exactly the same rare brain cancer. He also died quickly. I co-wrote a book a few years ago with a fellow named Joe Hickman, and Joe wrote a book on the burn pits in which he came to the same conclusions that these veterans have come to, that these burn pits cause cancer. So first of all, let's tell our listeners what a burn pit is. The way that that our military and military contractors dispose of solid waste when we invade a country and occupy it is you just bulldoze all of the waste, whether it's plastic or human body parts or food trash, literally everything that you produce, you bulldoze it into a pit, you douse it with jet fuel, which is sprayed from a fire truck, and then you light it on fire. That's it. And it just burns. It burns for months, and you keep bulldozing more and more garbage in it. Well, as you can imagine, it releases vast amounts of toxic smoke. And it turns out that that toxic smoke produces rare cancers. And our veterans are getting these cancers. Now, the vets lost at the federal district level. They appealed and lost at the circuit level. They appealed again to the Supreme Court. And last week, the Supreme Court refused to hear the case. We've got 1 minute left. Go ahead.
Right. Well, it's just, you know, and there's like hundreds of thousands of people who are affected by that. I think there's 160,000 veterans, even in the VA registry, who've complained about symptoms as a result of the burn pits. And I guess the basis for the decision is that KBR, the company that was being sued, was working at the direction of the military, and you can't sue the military, you know. So, but one way or another, they should be recognizing this whole syndrome. They should be providing compensation. They should be providing treatment for it. And it's the same old, same old. I mean, it's very, very similar to how Vietnam veterans who came back with symptoms from Agent Orange were for years and years and years fighting just to have it recognized that it even happened. And then once that happened, once they finally got that recognition, they had to continue to fight for the health care they needed and the compensation. In the meantime, many of them had died, and even their children have been born with malformities and serious disabilities as a result of the genetic impact. And I mentioned that might be the case here as well.
I think it will be. They're going to have to continue this fight. This can't end just because the Supreme Court wouldn't hear the case. They're going to have to fight it in the halls of government. We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from California by Jerry Condon. Jerry's a Vietnam-era veteran and war resister who's been a peace and solidarity activist for almost 50 years, currently as national president of Veterans for Peace. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
A lot of Democrats are running for president. Major media outlets say that as many as 24 Democrats are considering or have already announced campaigns. There are major names like Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, and Elizabeth Warren. Newcomers like Kamala Harris and Tulsi Gabbard, and unknowns like South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg and Maryland Congressman John Delaney. But are any of these politicians really any different from previous Democratic candidates? And do any of them really have a chance to beat Donald Trump? We're joined from Baltimore by Kevin Zeese. He's the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance, and you can check out their work at popularresistance.org. Welcome back, Kevin.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Kevin, I just in the last hour or two heard some obscure congressman on CNN saying that he believes as many as 40 Democrats may run for president in this election. 40 people. We mocked the Republicans when they had 22 last time.
You know, it's interesting.
Tell me.
That's the same as Donald Trump's positive rating.
That's right. It actually may be a point more. Yeah, everybody believes that that they have a chance. And there are some real competing ideologies here. I'd like to start by asking you about Tulsi Gabbard. It seems to me that some of the standard bearers, some of the mainstream Democratic candidates see Tulsi Gabbard as a real threat. And the way they respond to that threat is to criticize the messenger rather than the message. What do you think about Tulsi Gabbard? And do you think that the message that she has, one of being an anti-war progressive, is something that has resonance?
Well, you know, I think that's the real threat. A congressperson running from a small state, winning the presidency is a long shot. Tulsi's a very interesting candidate, and her message against the war, the various ongoing, never-ending wars, like Syria in particular, is the message that scares them. And that's what they're attacking. They are, you know, calling her an Assadist because she met with President Assad. She is thankfully standing strong against that and defending her position and not backing down. She has the potential to put the anti-war issue on the agenda. I think that will pull more likely candidates like Bernie Sanders in that direction. He's already started to say some positive things on cutting the military budget and the wars. He's not been great on foreign policy, so he needs to be pushed. I think Tulsi has the role of that. Of course, you have the ever-changing Joe Biden, who I think is a joke candidate, really, but he leads in the polls. I don't see him being a likely successor, but he'll hear that Tulsi message and also have to move his position to the left, as will Elizabeth Warren. So I think that's the role she plays. Maybe she'll take off and surprise us, and we'll see for the first time in, gosh, long time, a member of the House actually be competitive for the presidency. That'd be amazing. But she has an important message that I think has, in the past, just think, Obama beat Clinton because she was pro-Iraq war. Obama was against it. Also, Obama beat Clinton. Clinton lost to Trump because he was anti-interventionist. So there's an anti-interventionist feel in the country. And Tulsi's been very smart in playing a cross-partisan game, in that she's going to reach out to people who are independents as well as people who are Democrats. So I think she's an important player, raising important issues, and will move the agenda.
I think she is an important player, and I think that that the likes of the New York Times feel a little bit threatened by her. We've got a clip that we want to play. This is a clip from the Joe Rogan Show. Very, very popular show. He's got millions of followers on social media. He's interviewing a New York Times opinion writer by the name of Barry Weiss. And Barry Weiss tries to echo the mainstream media's criticisms of Tulsi Gabbard, but kind of falls flat. Let's listen to that.
No, she's an Assad toady.
What does that mean?
She is
What's a toady?
I think that I used that word correctly. Jamie, can you check what toady means?
Like toeing the line? Is that what it means?
No, I think it's like a T-O-A-D-I-E.
What does that mean?
I think it means what I think it means.
Toady, definition of toadies. A person
a
who flatters or defers to others
kind
for self-serving
right.
reasons.
A sycophant.
So she's an Assad sycophant. Is that what you're saying?
That's known about her.
Like, what did she say that
we have
qualifies
to look,
her?
I don't remember the details.
So there it is. That's the organized opposition to Tulsi Gabbard.
Oh, I don't know if you heard me laughing as I was playing, but that was amazing.
That's a New York Times editorial writer
who ought
to be one of the most well-informed people in the United States.
You know, it reminds me, Kevin, and I know you know about this, and John, you're aware of it. Before the Iraq War, before 2003, March 19th, I was going sort of regularly on MSNBC and Fox News and CNN as an anti-war voice because I was one of the leaders of the Answer Coalition, and we were organizing big demos. And right towards the end, right before we all got those of us who are anti-war got taken off the air, the tone and tenor started changing, and people on the other side started saying to me, oh, you're a Saddam Hussein apologist. You're an agent of Saddam Hussein. I was a toady. In other words, this is the tried and true tactic against anyone who defies the neocon war consensus in Washington. If you go and meet with the enemy, if you talk about the enemy, if you say the enemy shouldn't be destroyed, you're a, quote, toady. Now we know exactly what toady means.
Yeah, since the New York Times had to actually look it up and tell us.
Indeed.
That was the funniest interview. But the New York Times, of course, on these kinds of issues of U.S. militarism is not to be trusted. You know, you go back to that Iraq war invasion. They reprinted Cheney press releases as if they were facts. They didn't report on intelligence authorities in the U.S. who questioned the false intelligence of weapons of mass destruction, even though they were out there saying it. They were not being reported in the New York Times. So the New York Times is classic. And I think they don't like Tulsi because she's challenging as Brian says, the bipartisan pro-war, pro-militarism position that New York Times echoes.
Kevin, let me ask you about Kamala Harris. Kamala Harris, at first glance, is an extraordinarily attractive candidate in that she's a sitting U.S. senator. She was the attorney general of California. She was a successful prosecutor. She comes off as very tough in the Senate Judiciary Committee. But it seems to me like she's really not much more than a mainstream Hillary Clinton Democrat. Isn't that the kind of candidate that the Democratic Party wants to move beyond?
Well, you say the Democratic Party wants to move beyond. I think Democratic Party is in a war amongst itself. It's a war between what their voters want and what their funders want. It's a war between the really outrageous corporate Democrats and the more progressive Democrats, the Sanders Democrats versus anyone they can find to beat Sanders. And I think Kamala could play that role. You're right. Her record as a prosecutor and attorney general is a great way to see her. If you look at that record, you can find she can make the case that she was a progressive prosecutor against the death penalty, against three strikes, you know, also going after violent criminals, going after for. But then if you actually scratch the surface and see what she did, you find her to be a horrible prosecutor, a horrible attorney general, who actually did not stand up against these issues and spoke rhetorically, you know, sounded good, looked good, smiled well, played the identity card well as a black Asian woman. You know, so she's challenging in that way, but she is the classic corporate Democrat who says you can see what you want in her as a voter. And that's the most successful, the Obama-type Democrats who can say things that people hear who are progressive and say, oh, that sounds good. But then when they get into power, you're going to have the knife in your back because she's not going to do what you say. Now, she's moved like she, you know, 4 years ago, she laughed when she was asked about legal marijuana. Last year, she came out for legal marijuana. She's come out for Medicare for all. She's come out for free college tuition, Green New Deal. So she's clicking off all the progressive boxes.
Kevin, we want to continue to look at the different candidates as we go forward. And real quick, we only have about 2 minutes left. I want to ask you two questions. You can answer them sequentially. One is, I'm just looking and remembering Elizabeth Warren's stance, which was all about a pro-Israeli position when Israel was bombing the heck out of Gaza. She voted for the authorization of $225 million for Israel in the middle of that assault against Gaza. And then she doubled down and supported that. And also, given the tone and tenor, including the attacks even on Tulsi Gabbard, what do you think about the Green Party? The Green Party is going to be also ridiculed by the Democratic Party mainstream just for existing, because the Democrats presume that anybody who votes for the Green Party is a stolen vote from the Democrat. Anyway, we have about 90 seconds left. Can you answer both?
I'm a Green Party candidate. I'm an activist, and so I believe in third parties, but I also know it's a rigged election system, and it's going to be very hard for any third party candidate, a left third party in particular, running in 2020. It's going to be 2004 all over again. Anybody but Bush, anybody but Trump. It's going to be a big attack. But I think we need to run. I think we need to build the party, because the 2020 is going to be a key decade. Elizabeth Warren, you know, is being pulled. And just like Sanders was wrong on Israel for a long time, during the last campaign, he moved so he was the only candidate not to speak at the AIPAC conference. And he's been pretty good since. Warren needs to be pushed. And I think Tulsi Gabbard in the race will help move her on those foreign policy issues.
I think that's exactly right. We will leave it there. We were joined from Baltimore by Kevin Zeese. Kevin's the co-founder of Popular Resistance, and you can check out their work at popularresistance.org. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Our friend and contributor Ted Rall recently had a major court decision go against him in California. This was a case that had very important implications for Americans' constitutional rights to freedom of speech. In the end, the court decided essentially that Ted's right to criticize the Los Angeles Police Department was less important than the Los Angeles Times' right to block Ted's right to freedom of speech. It's a case with very important constitutional implications. Ted Rall joins us from New York to talk about it. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist, and you can check out his work at www.rawl.com. Welcome back, Ted.
Thank you.
Ted, sorry about this case. I followed it. You've been posting links on Twitter, and like many of your friends and followers, I thought that you had such a strong constitutional argument here that this was kind of a no-brainer. And that's not what the court had ended up doing. Can you tell our listeners about the nature of this case and how it came to be?
Sure. I was the editorial cartoonist for the LA Times for 6 years, from 2009 to 2015. And unbeknownst to me, in 2014, the LAPD pension fund became the number one shareholder of the LA Times parent company, Tribune Publishing, which for a time was also called Tronc. In about a year later, in 2015, I received a call that from the LA Times telling me that the LAPD had taken issue with a blog post that accompanied a cartoon I had done about the LAPD jaywalking crackdown against people of color and poor people in downtown LA. In the blog, I mentioned that 14 years prior, in 2001, I had been arrested for jaywalking and mistreated by an LAPD officer, and that I had filed a complaint at the time, and that the cop had handcuffed me and treated me roughly, and that several people who were watching had taken issue and were shouting at the cop. The LA Times said the LAPD had given them an audio recording secretly taken by the police officer in 2001 of my jaywalking arrest, and that it showed that I had not been handcuffed and I had not been mistreated, and there was no angry crowd. Shortly thereafter, about a day later, the Times fired me and published an article stating that I was a liar and a fabulist in the LA Times, as an obvious attempt not just to get rid of me for them, but also to make sure that I might not be able to work as a journalist or a cartoonist at all in the future. In about a week later, I got the audio in question enhanced, cleaned up, and it showed that, in fact, you could hear the people shouting at the police officer that he should take off my handcuffs. So I was, I had told the truth, and the tape showed that. So I sent it to the Times. They ignored it. 3 weeks later, they published another piece after they were under a lot of pressure from other news outlets and from social media to do something to rectify this error that they had made. And they decided to double down, and they published a second longer piece reaffirming their decision to fire me and calling me a liar and fabulist again. And then this time they quoted so-called audio experts that they said they had hired. In fact, they did not really hire them. They didn't have them do a proper enhancement, and we found that out later. I sued for defamation and wrongful termination in LA court. I waited 9 months because I really wanted them to just take me back without having to do litigation. But I sued finally. The Times responded with something called an anti-SLAPP motion. SLAPP stands for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation. It's a theory that goes back to the tort reform movement of the Reagan years in the 1980s, that basically there are these frivolous lawsuits that are used not with an intent to win, but the goal is simply to intimidate individuals who are challenging a large corporation. So anti-SLAPP laws first passed in California in 1992, and now in 28 other states, although two of those states have since ruled anti-SLAPP unconstitutional, is a very powerful defense motion used to defend yourself against a libel or defamation claim. And what it does is it stays discovery. It stops the case from moving forward until a judge, not a jury, but a judge decides whether or not the case can go forward. If the judge decides the case can't go forward based on a variety of technicalities, then you, the plaintiff, have to pay the defendant their legal fees. So that's what happened at the trial court level at LA Superior Court. The judge ruled in favor of the LA Times against me and issued a judgment against me for $330,000 in LA Times legal fees. And then I appealed to the Court of Appeal. It's automatically appealable under anti-SLAPP. And there's going to be, I lost there last week. And it's going to be, there's the thin possibility of being able to appeal to the court, to the California Supreme Court, but they don't, they only take about 5% of cases. So it's not likely that they will hear my petition, but it's possible.
Ted Rawl is our guest. We're talking about what happened to Ted. It's really something, Ted. The First Amendment, the freedom of the press, was used against you rather than in defense of you. And you made the argument, you made the point that the what the court basically ruled is that the freedom of press part of the Constitution, the First Amendment, the cherished First Amendment, was used by powerful corporations against you, a vulnerable journalist. But in the name of the freedom of the press, the court ruled that they couldn't rule on your behalf or something like that, some twisted logic. Talk about that.
What's interesting is that the LA Times framed their defense as claiming falsely that I was demanding to be reinstated as the LA Times cartoonist as a remedy to what happened. That's false. We have never, in fact, we haven't asked for any remedy at all. We assume that if we went to trial and we were to win, there would be a monetary reward. The Times successfully framed it before the court as saying that I want to force them to run my cartoons again. And the First Amendment allows a newspaper to run or not run anything they want. And so that I'm essentially trying to stuff Ted Rawl cartoons down their throats. But that's just not true. You know, the court bought that. But we repeatedly said we're not asking for that. What we're asking for and what the result of this ruling is actually, I mean, I feel really bad about this. It has sweeping implications for journalists in the state of California because it essentially now creates a separate class of employee. If you're a janitor at the LA Times and you're fired because the boss is a racist, you have a remedy. But if you're a journalist at the LA Times, and you're fired because the boss is a racist, because of this ruling, you no longer have any status to challenge the LA Times. They have effectively created journalists as a second class of employee in the state of California at any media outlet. They're saying that the Times and all media organizations, because of the anti-SLAPP law, are privileged to libel and defame at will, and that there's no remedy in court.
Ted, did you get any support from established freedom of speech groups or freedom of the press groups, maybe the ACLU or any of the pressure groups that ought to be or ought to have been your natural allies here?
The short answer is no. ACLU and EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, both outright refused to participate because they did not want to be seen as opposing the anti-SLAPP law. Again, that's stupid because I didn't oppose the anti-SLAPP law constitutionally. I simply said my argument was that it didn't apply to me. And it doesn't, really, if you read it carefully. The problem is the judges are either corrupt or stupid, and they didn't read it correctly. And there was an offer of an amicus brief from PEN America, but when they checked with their law firm that would have prepared it, it turned out that there was a conflict between them and Tronc. One of the things that big corporations do is they try to retain as many different law firms as possible in order to block possible plaintiffs, because if, let's say a firm has 1,000 lawyers, if even one of those lawyers represents the defendant in your case, that firm can't take your case. So for example, in LA, the LA Times retains most law firms in the city. So it's very hard to find an attorney at all who even can take your case, much less wants to take it. And anyway, there were other organizations, the National Writers Union, National Coalition Against Censorship, Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, several others that would have issued amicus briefs, but they couldn't afford it. They were all willing to sign on to some to PENs if they were able to do it. But we're trying to regroup now for the Supreme Court and to get amicus briefs going for that. And with a little luck, maybe we will. But there was no support, and there's a complete, except for this show, a media blackout, really, on my case.
I want to remind people, too, to go to your website, www.rall.com. This is where your blog resides, and you go into a lot of great detail. This is an important case. People ought to know about it. And it's not just, you know, this guy, Ted, fighting a case. This has implications for all of us, especially when you're a journalist, you're a commentator, an editorial cartoonist, whatever you are, and you're going up against a major corporation.
A major corporation that, again, let's go back, the LAPD, the notorious Los Angeles Police Department, it's their pension that became the major holder of the Los Angeles Times, the major investor in the Los Angeles Times. Is that right? This was preceded
in their parent company. Yeah, in their parent company. So it's a $16 billion pension fund, and they invested deeply in Tribune Publishing, which owned at the time 15 papers. Now the LA Times has been sold to a biotechnology billionaire named Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong, who runs a company called Nantech, and he is worth about $7 billion, but I guess he wants about $500,000 more from me.
Yeah. Again, you make the point that you are making about $300 a week. The LA Times has a $7 billion, they're sitting at $7 billion, and they succeeded in convincing a judge, not a jury, a judge, that you should pay them $330,000 because you tried to stand up for your own rights. Amazing.
Here's to taking this to the California Supreme Court. That was Ted Rall. Ted joined us from New York. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. Check out his work at www.rall.com. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.